My name's Jeremy England, and I am currently living in Modi'in here in Israel. I
Nice.
used to live in the Boston area in the US, and I guess at the moment I'm in a somewhat different configuration, but for a while I was a physics professor. I guess the motivation for this series in general has been I've been interested for quite some time in discourses on scientific reasoning that can be unearthed from the Torah. We often think about the Torah as being about things other than science, and and sometimes that's kind of a notion we pick up from the society around us. But I think it's very interesting to go to the Torah and assume, as I think is appropriate, that it's much smarter than we are, that it knows everything we know and more. And if that's the case, then it knows what science is. And then it is interesting to ask what it has to say about what science is, that might be sufficiently nuanced to capture both what might be good or useful about science, but also what might be limited or some kind of dangerous or slippery slope, about it as well. And so the conception of this series was just to talk about that in a few different versions and different topics. So the first topic I wanted to try to get into tonight is a little bit about the idea of predicting the world using science and how that might differ from other ways of predicting the world that the tradition and the Torah understand, and both what might be the positive implications of being able to do that, and the negative ones. And the nice thing is, it actually connects a lot to recent parshiot that have been read over the course of the last few weeks on Shabbatot, because we have these portions that are about the family of Yaakov, and particularly the sons of Yaakov, and above all of them, Yosef. So we're going to start off by talking about Yosef, and it will take us in a few different directions. We'll think about what the Torah may have to say about what it's like to predict the future, thinking about the world like a scientist might, and also perhaps what it's like to make arguments about what might have happened in the past, thinking like a scientist might, and both the advantages or the dangers of those activities. So to start off, this is a story probably a lot of people are familiar with, so we're not going to read through this whole source, but this is the dreams of the brothers, sorry, the dreams of Yosef and how he explains them to his brothers. So remember that Yosef is the son of Yaakov. He's one of 11, sorry, he's the 11th of 12 sons. He has dreams which he tells his brothers about. And we all think we know what the dreams mean because when the dreams are described in this source number one, an interpretation is immediately given by the brothers because they hear the dreams and they say, "Oh, you think it means you're going to rule over us." And we also confirm that from our knowledge of what the story does later, right? Because then eventually Yosef is ruling over his brothers. So we think it's all very cut and dry. This is what the dreams mean because this is the interpretation given by the brothers and it comes true. So we don't have to think about it more. But I think it's important to ask ourselves whether there are other interpretations of these dreams not being offered by the brothers that might also turn out to be true. And that's actually a point that's raised in the Midrash. I didn't bring that source here, but when later Yosef is interpreting the dreams of Paro, the king of Egypt, the Midrash Rabbah tells us that actually Paro had asked other interpreters to interpret his dreams and didn't like what he heard, that someone told him that his dreams meant that he would have seven daughters and bury seven daughters. And so maybe that was also true. Who knows? The point is that actually there might be multiple interpretations to dreams, and we should be thinking about whether the same dreams could mean different things. This is one of the things that I think Chazal, our sages, are trying to encourage us to think about there. So if we bring that back into this source, what do we know about Yosef? What does he ultimately do? He gets sold by his brothers into slavery in Egypt. He goes down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, and eventually he rises to being the second in command in the Egyptian Empire, and he becomes the master controller and commander of the entire agricultural economy of Mitzrayim, of Egypt. And so he's going to be the greatest farmer in the world, in a sense. And the interesting thing here, I think, then, is to look at the first dream that Yosef is describing to his brothers. ultimately, Yosef's brothers are coming to him and bowing down and begging for food, right? So he's going to be able to give them that food because he's a better farmer than they are. And that is one thing that we could pull out of this dream. If we were not coming to it with knowledge of everything that happens and with the interpretation the brothers offer, one thing it might mean that the sheaves of grain of the brothers are bowing down to his is that he's going to be a better farmer than they are. And that's true. That turns out to be true. He's a better agronomist than his brothers. They're more shepherds, and he turns out to be more of a farmer. So why is that interesting? I think it's interesting because you could also read the second dream as kind of an explanation for the first one, because the second dream is about celestial bodies. It's about the stars and the sun and the moon. And in the ancient world, this was more obvious, but if you're a better astronomer, that helps you to be a better farmer. Why? Because if you're going to be a good farmer, there's a time to plant and a time to reap, as we have in Kohelet, and you need to know when to do these things. And telling time that as pertains to the natural world, things like the seasons, the months, etc., that has to do with celestial bodies. So if you're not really keeping track of what's going on up in the sky, you're not really going to be able to make good decisions as you see patterns over time about when it's good to plant and when it's good to reap and when it's good to plow, etc. So this is the starting hypothesis. Can we explain some of what's going on with Yosef by thinking about this as though the second dream is the explanation for the first, and it's really telling us something about how Yosef succeeds, right? He predicts the future of the agricultural economy in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, and he does that because, in a sense, he's attuned to that which is most regular and predictable about the natural world that he experiences. And I don't want to just talk about it in terms of the narrow sense of telling time, although I think that that's there in the text if you want. We hear 11 stars and the sun and the moon, and of course we think, oh, 11 brothers and the sun and the moon are the 11 brothers and his parents. And again, that's the interpretation given. But it's also notable that 11 stars plus the sun and the moon makes 12 celestial bodies plus the moon, right? So the number 12 plus the moon. 12 plus the moon is obviously something that we put together and think, oh, it's about months, right? So it is about telling time. But it's also, in another sense, more broadly about natural science, right? It's about the idea of there being things in nature that are regular and predictable. And they have a hierarchy of patterns of predictability, right? The most predictable thing is that the sun will rise every day, unless you live, I don't know, in Greenland or something. But basically speaking, you can rely on the sun rising every day, certainly in Mitzrayim and in Eretz Canaan. And then it's more complicated to talk about what the moon is doing. It's even more complicated to notice differences between planets and other stars, etc. But there are different layers of predictability that you can discern. And really, the sky was the most accessible form of natural predictability that you had before people really invested a lot in figuring out what else there was to scientize in the world. It's very hard to do atomic physics experiments in the middle of a field with stampeding herds of cattle there, or in a rainstorm or something like that. It's hard actually to realize there's a lot that's predictable about the world on the ground, and the world in the sky, relatively speaking, is pristine and regular, and it goes like clockwork, and there's a lot that you can notice there that really is never off track. And so it's this emblem of regular, predictable, natural order that someone who's going to think about that and notice it could start to turn into an ability to say, I think this is going to happen because I know that the world kind of has to work this way, that it's like the stars in the heavens. It's moving on fixed tracks. Its fates have been set. So that's the idea in a nutshell. The idea is, let's think about Yosef as though he's a natural scientist, meaning that he's going to be able to predict the future in a way that really is rooted ultimately in noticing that which is naturally predictable about the world. And in that sense, he differs from other predictors that we hear about in the Torah, like, for example, his forebears, right? Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are what we tend to call Nevi'im, right? They're prophets. And we think of their ability to see the future as being about a communicative act, the idea that the creator of the world is sort of letting them in on a secret. And I think we're so accustomed to that when we come to Yosef that we tend to kind of think, well, you know, so people can predict the future. It's a premise of this text. We don't really have to wonder why. But it is notable that the Torah never says, Vayomer Hashem ad Yosef, in the way that it does with other people. And I would even add, going down to source two, sorry, let's skip to source three, that in Sefer Dvarim, as a matter of halacha, it's interesting that the Torah doesn't just say there are Nevi'im, there are people who predict the future and they're called Nevi'im, they're called prophets. It makes a distinction, or at least verbosely lays out categories in a way that maybe makes it unclear whether a prophet is the only way, being a prophet is the only way someone can predict the future. It says, what if someone comes up among you who is either a prophet, a Navi, or a cholem chalom, a dreamer of a dream? And that is something we know Yosef is, right? He is a dreamer of a dream. Now, there may be mefakshim who have said cholem chalom is a Navi. You know, if you want to read the Rambam about what it is to be a Navi, or other people, maybe they would describe it as a process of having a dream. So we can argue about that. But just reading the Pasuk in Dvarim, it's interesting that the Torah wants to not just say Navi, but to say Navi o cholem chalom, that maybe someone could predict the future, not by being a Navi, but by being a dreamer of a dream. Yosef is a dreamer of a dream. So we're going to explore the idea that what that might mean is actually that they're more like a theorist, right? Someone who's looking at the world and trying to develop a concept in their mind. The same way that a dream is a set of a collection of imagery that you might sometimes kind of say becomes analogous to things, that stands for things. Theorizing about the world very often works the same way. So if we conceive of Yosef in that way, and we say he's good at predicting the world actually because he's more like a theorist about what's predictable about nature, then first of all, can we see evidence in the text that supports that idea? And also, what does that mean for his story? What are we supposed to learn from that reading of it? And I'm very much in favor of saying, Shivim Panim LaTorah, there are 70 faces to the Torah. This is not meant to displace other ways of looking at Yosef and where and how and why he does what he does. But I think it's an important aspect of what the text is showing us. So in source number two, I think there's at least one bit of evidence that we may be a little bit on the right track here. If we go to the bracha given in Parshat Vezot HaBracha by Moshe Rabbeinu, at the end of the Torah, when he's talking about the different tribes, and he talks about Yosef, the bracha he gives to Yosef explicitly conflates in a sort of mashup the idea of agricultural bounty and celestial bodies, right? So in the dreams, they're separate. You have a dream about agriculture, and then you have a dream about celestial bodies. But here, it says that you have Meged Tfu'ot Shamesh, so the bounteous yield of the sun, Umi Meged Geresh Yerachim, and the bounteous crop of the moons. Now, the sun, it's more obvious what the sun has to do with agricultural bounty because you need sunlight and warmth for plants to grow. But to say that the moon has to do with it, that forces you to think, okay, what is the moon doing that has to do with agriculture? It has to do with the predictability of the world and the timing, right? It's not, it tracks the seasons and the passage of time, but the idea that the moon has some other power to influence agricultural bounty, I mean, it's not as obvious as what we think of when we talk about the sun. So I think that that's bringing us into the idea of maybe saying the story with Yosef is that somehow relationship to the celestial bodies is connected with agricultural bounty and the way that he's predicting the world. So another point I think we want to try to flesh out here is when Yosef describes his interpretation of Paro's dream, he says something else that to me as a scientist and someone who tries to make theoretical models of things, it certainly tickles my nose, because what he says to Paro is that you've had two different dreams and they are the same dream. And that means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to bring this matter to pass and will carry it out. So what that reminds me of, if you think in terms of, you know, describing the world like a physicist, is that if you're really right about talking about something that's truly predictable about the world, there's very often different ways you can make a predictive model that summarizes that predictability. So you can write down Newton's laws and you can describe the mechanics of things flying around and bouncing off of each other in terms of forces and in terms of acceleration and mass, et cetera. But you also can formulate the exact same predictions in a completely different way called Lagrangian mechanics, where you write down a different set of equations and you make the same predictions. And I think that there's something that is quite astute in this pasuk, in this verse, that's capturing the same kind of idea that if there's something out there in the world that you can really latch onto and say, if you're wise and you notice something that's predictable about the world, you're going to talk about it analogically or metaphorically, because that's how you theorize, how you dream up an explanation for what's happening. You need to tell a story that sort of compares the actual world to some sort of abstracted world that has pieces that obey rules that you've dreamed up. And you make those rules up in analogy to things that you see in the world. So there should be more than one way of analogizing or metaphorizing that underlying predictability, because at the end, you're the dreamer coming up with the model, and the world admits different ways of being talked about that are suitable for capturing something that's true about it. So that's another point that I think weighs in that favor. In the end, I think I'm not going to try from the text to prove incontrovertibly that we now know it was only natural science that allowed Yosef to do what he did. But I think the point is more that reasoning about what's predictable about the natural world is something that it's a very old idea. It's an idea that actually could be part of the discourse of the ancient world and not something that we just kind of made up yesterday. We have this very rarefied set of theoretical ideas now that are very empowering, and you can do a lot with modern science. But this way of talking about the world is much more ancient, and moreover, the Torah can always kind of speak to any generation and contain knowledge of what's going to matter in that generation. So what I want to propose for the rest of the discussion is that we run with the idea of Yosef as a natural scientist. And not just that, he's kind of, you could say, like a climatologist or an astronomer or an agronomist or, you know, all those things together. That's how he knows something about what's predictable about agriculture in Mitzrayim, when there's going to be lots of crops and lots of grain and when there's going to be a famine, which is the big deal in what he does. But he's not only that, he's also kind of a hedge fund manager, right? He's figuring out the economic implications of that. He's buying high and selling low. And he's also a politician, right? He's figuring out how to take that knowledge that he has and make the right deal with the person in power so that instead of just having an idea that can predict what happens without consequence, it can become an argument for policy. It can become a motivation to change the way people do things. And that is this very potent combination, the idea of being a good scientist and a good economist and a good politician. And you put those three things together, and that makes Yosef almost king of the world, because he really has figured out a whole lot about what's going on and knows how to motivate people to great consequence as a result of having figured that out. And that, I think, is maybe one of these things that's summarized in what Paro says to Yosef. This is now in source 5. Vayomer Paro el Yosef acharei hodia Elohim otcha et kol zot ein navon v'chacham kamocha. That Paro is saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has made all of this known to you. So you are, you know, chacham more than anyone else. You're very wise, and I think that this is the idea then that we want to latch onto with Yosef, the notion that Yosef's relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides the rules for what will happen, but then if you are chacham, if you are smart, you figure out those rules, and then you can kind of take advantage of that knowledge, which is a very different kind of posture than you see from someone like Avraham Avinu, from Moshe Rabbeinu, right? They're much more in a kind of a dialogue with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, where their relationship is more based on tefillah or nivuah, like prophecy, you know, prayer and prophecy, that there's it's communicative, and it's very much more in a state, I don't want to say of submission, but let's say of humility, in the face of a creator whose will can be expressed in any way, right? When Moshe brings a message, it's I will be what I will be. Like, there are no rules for HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he decides he wants to do something. And what he does in Mitzrayim ultimately with the plagues and everything else, the splitting of the sea, etc., is very dramatically, it's working within the natural world, but it's trying to show that the natural world can kind of be malleable, that you can, Hashem can just use it as a medium for communication, because he's not constrained in sort of what happens next. He can decide on the order of events. And that's a very different notion than the idea of stars wheeling on their tracks, that they can't move off of them because they're natural laws that hold everything in place. So we don't have time in this whole hour to build up both sides of this completely, but I think actually there's a much larger, and we'll get in some of the later shiurim to some degree into this comparison, that Yosef is really kind of the opposite of Moshe in many, many ways. And this plays out, midrashically and in other respects. And you could compare them in many respects that have nothing to do with this discussion and find them to be opposites. But one way I think they're very clearly opposites is that Yosef represents the very non-prophetic, natural, technical planner way of saving everyone and feeding them, because he does that, right? He plans years ahead. He's thinking years ahead about, well, whether there'll be enough to eat. Moshe, on the other hand, is the one who's constantly surrounded by seemingly miraculous occurrences, including that he takes a whole nation with a few days' supply of food and water into a desert, and they don't starve to death, right? So the complete opposite of Yosef. And Yosef is the one who's planning so far ahead that he's thinking about where his bones are going to be buried generations later, and who carries his bones there but Moshe. So it's all very woven together. But we're going to focus on Yosef and the implications of that today. So what this is preparing us for is a very peculiar midrash that I think hints at many aspects of how we're now supposed to react as a matter of commentary to what we've been claiming so far. Because so far we've just been kind of building up this idea of, okay, so Yosef, maybe we can think of him as a scientist. That's interesting. That's certainly showing us in an example how science can be maybe useful, because it seems like he's the hero of the story. He saves people's lives. But we have to ask ourselves now, so, if science is so great, why doesn't the Torah start with, you should all be scientists or something like that? That's one way of posing the question. Or why do we have to work so hard to draw this out of the text? Why is it not kind of pushed closer to the surface? And a real, maybe the most important question, which I always think we should be asking when we're trying to demonstrate that the Torah is kind of aware of an idea and is playing around with it in narrative, is what is the Torah's comment as a message to the Oved Hashem, right? That we're reading the Torah because we're supposed to be Oved Hashem. We're supposed to be serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we want to learn about our mission and find out how we're supposed to act in the course of fulfilling that mission. So if the Torah is going to sort of talk about natural science and predicting the world, it's not just going to do that stam. It's not going to do it on a lark or just to show you, kind of like wink at you and show that it knows something. It wants to make a comment on what this means for people who are trying to live their lives according to the mission laid out in the Torah, which is, Avodat Hashem, service of the world's creator. So where does that comment start to come in? Where do we find that in the tradition? And I think that before sort of getting into sources that pertain to this, I think there's a few things that we can already observe that are interesting. So on the one hand, there's kind of a positive light in which we can view Yosef, especially as kids. We just think of him as the hero of the story, right? He's very smart. He saves the whole world. He saves his family from starvation. He becomes this prince who's lofted from the dungeons into a place of royal power and position. And it seems like the world was saved from a calamity that he essentially averted. So sounds great, right? But when the other foot drops in Parshat Vayigash, it doesn't look so unalloyed, right? There's also the fact that Yosef is the architect of mass enslavement, right? He's standing there sort of totaling up the bill as people come and sell their livestock and land and give all their money and eventually sell themselves as slaves to Paro. And when we think about Egyptian slavery, that's not usually something we think of that the Torah portrays in a positive light, because the rest of the Torah is obviously about how awful that is and how we're supposed to be getting away from that with Moshe. So clearly there is kind of an ugly underside to what happens with Yosef. And in fact, you can even, I think, say more than that. You can look at Yosef and say, he spent most of his life, or if you add up all the years, maybe it's not most, but the narratively significant years of his life, he spent mostly either as a slave or as a prisoner or enslaving people or imprisoning people, like Jimon, for example, right? So the whole association of his story is about this idea of constraint, of being locked in, much like the stars in the sky that are sort of locked into their tracks, right? There's this notion of having no sort of freedom to deviate that is in this cloud of connotations around him. And maybe that's not so surprising, because that is kind of how we start to look at the world once we start talking about it as though everything is set by a set of natural laws that are sort of set down at the beginning. And now we worry about things like, can we make free choices? Or we worry about things like who is responsible for their actions, or what is the point of all of it? And we worry about things like, you know, can HaKadosh Baruch Hu does he have to intervene and break rules in order to make things to happen? Like, how is that supposed to work? When is he making things happen? And when is he not making things happen? And I think a lot of these are actually ill-posed kind of philosophical paradoxes that there isn't so much a resolution of, as we have to recognize that we should pose the question differently. But the point is, Yosef becomes a real emblem of that. I'm sorry, was there a question or comment? Oh, no, that was my own voice reverberating. I think something unmuted. Anyway, so now where do we go with this from here? I think the source that seems to me to be the hinge for this discussion is not pasted here, because I'm sorry, I'm still learning how to be a wizard with Sepharia, and it was a very long source as quoted there, because it's a bunch of Midrashim. One of which is a comment in Tehillim Rabbah about this pasuk here in source 6. So this is from Hallel that has just been read 8 times for the last 8 days over the course of Hanukkah. Hayam ra'av yenos hayoden yisov le'acho. So the sea saw and fled, and the Jordan ran backward, or whatever it did. The Hayam Ra'av Yanos is the thing we're focusing on. The sea saw and fled. What sea is it talking about? What does it mean for the sea to flee? So Midrash Rabbah, Tehillim Rabbah, quotes Shimon HaKitron saying, what was it that the sea saw? We're talking about Kriyat Yam Suf. We're talking about the splitting of the sea when Moshe led the Israelites out of Egyptian slavery. Why did the sea split? It's because it saw the bones of Yosef that Moshe was carrying, which is a very cryptic and puzzling statement. You could make different things out of it. The bones of Yosef, for example, show that Yosef was, you know, he loved Eretz Yisrael so much that he was thinking generations ahead about where he was going to be buried, and said he wanted to be buried there. So maybe it was in the zchut, in the merit of that desire, that the sea split. You can make it that simple, and that's wonderful. But the pasuk is also connected to a pasuk in Chumash that's part of the story that we're talking about in order to justify this, right? Because when Chazal are saying, Hayam Ra Vayanos, the sea saw and fled, and they explain it as having to do with Yosef, they take the word Vayanos and they go to Chumash, they go to Parshiot that we've been reading recently, and they say, that is because when the wife of Potiphar tried to grab Yosef and make him lie down with her, that he ran outside. Vayanos Vayetze HaChutza. And actually in that whole passage, Vayanos is over and over and over again repeated many times, that he fled away from her. So he makes this choice not to do what's easy and not to cuckold his master, Potiphar. And that turns out to be, in the short term, a very bad move, because it lands him in prison. But it's still not entirely an explanation for why the sea would split for that purpose. And I think you have to kind of unpack that and develop different ideas or proposals. I don't think we need this proposal to be 100% right to get to the rest of what we want to say today. But I think the way that I have tended to try to argue about this one is that this is a moment of significant moral choice that Yosef demonstrates, right? That his life, if we think of him as someone who is always about what is prudent, what that always is, he's very chacham, he's very clever, he's doing, you know, what's rational and exploiting that which is predictable. This, in some sense, might be an unpredictable move, because, you know, in the short term, it certainly is the wrong one, right? If he's acting in his own self-interest, it lands him in prison. And no one, I think, when they get sent to an Egyptian prison, thinks that this is their way of eventually becoming viceroy of the whole empire, right? This was not a shrewd calculation on his part. So he made a choice to bring calamity on himself. And he says explicitly, because he doesn't want to commit a sin against God, right? So he's doing this out of a moral compunction. And that, I think, is the emblem that we're really getting from the bones of Yosef being carried by Moshe, right? That moral compunction is being linked in our tradition to natural unpredictability, right? Because it's really about human choice, that the sea can be as temperamental and unpredictable as the human spirit in some sense. And you can't act like, you know, before Yosef makes that choice, what is he going to do? And you can make different theories of why he would do what he would do. Indeed, there's another Midrash saying that when the brothers came down to Mitzrayim, they went to look for him in brothels because they thought that was a likely place to find him, which says perhaps the likely prediction in the case of his encounter with Eshet Potiphar is that he would do the wrong thing, the immoral thing, based on what his brothers expected, right? But you can't say what someone will choose before they choose it. You can have hypotheses, but they can be wrong. And so in a way that's very, you know, a theme that runs through Chazal and many other places, there is a kind of conflation of the temperamental personality of human beings, and therefore that, you know, the connection to moral choice, and that ends up being expressed in the natural unpredictability of a world that's created by a creator who sometimes wants to make nisim, by anos, you know, nun samech, nisim, miracles, that show a moral intention hiding behind what seems to be natural law. So that is, let's say, the first half of what we want to say. And the second half will take less than the remaining time that we have, so then we can hopefully have some discussion, which is, I think, a good part of this. But what I want to turn to is talking a bit about the past instead of the future. So far we've been talking about Yosef as a predictor of the future, who recognizes what is regular and predictable about the natural world, and he exploits that knowledge with his wisdom for political and economic success and gain. And there are positive aspects to that. There are also very negative aspects to that. And I think even you could say that, in a sense, this outcome with Egyptian slavery at the end, it's really not just talking about the actual political outcome, although that's also something you have to worry about, right? That if you just cut a deal with a powerful politician and say, look, I have a very powerful predictive mechanism, would you like to use it? You can make people powerful who shouldn't be made powerful. But there's another thing as well, which is that it is interesting to note that although Yosef starts off explaining his predictive power as though the knowledge comes from the creator of the world, he credits over and over again HaKadosh Baruch Hu with being the reason that he can make these predictions or these interpretations, that when you push to that logical extreme the notion that the world is just a bunch of mechanisms laid out by the chooser of natural laws, you end up not giving the right amount of credit to the creator of the world. You end up actually worshiping the God King who claims to know and control all of those natural laws. That there's sort of this bait and switch where Yosef's faithful reaction to his own wisdom about the natural world doesn't translate when he takes that knowledge and makes it available to everyone. That when you tell everyone about science and how powerful it is, that it doesn't actually instill them with faith in the creator of the world. It instills them with faith in Paro, in a sense, with the God King, who is this sort of false idol who stands for complete power over and knowledge of the world's predictability. So this is the real slippery slope that we're supposed to be worrying about, I would argue, in the society today, which is dominated by the successes of science, a trillionfold compared with what could have been possible in the time of Yosef. And it's very hard sometimes for people to look at the world through lenses that allow them to see the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu anywhere. And they're much more likely to kind of give credit to events, to a description of what the world is and how it works, that totally focuses on human knowledge of what's predictable. And that doesn't mean that that knowledge is useless. It's extremely important and useful. You can save life. You can keep the Torah better using that knowledge, right? But there is a danger of serving Paro instead of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that, I think, is how we're supposed to look at this when we talk about the future and prediction. But we can also ask a different question. We can ask about what science is good for as far as learning about the past, right? Because we also use the notion of the world's predictability to try to look backwards. We say, if the world, you know, operates according to rules that we know, then I can look at evidence in the present, and I can make hypotheses about what should have happened in order to produce that result. And of course, I have to make assumptions to get there. But, you know, people might think many assumptions are reasonable, and we can make observations in the present. And based on those assumptions, we can walk things backwards and kind of imagine, how did things get to be the way they are, and what did things used to be like? And we do that in a variety of respects with modern science. We do it with the Big Bang. We do it with dinosaurs. We also do it forensically in the sort of CSI sense of, you know, how do you tell where this body came from, so to speak, and you solve it in the Agatha Christie way. Looking at the evidence. So there's a related discourse to this whole story that's about how we should look at that kind of reasoning from evidence. So it's not about predicting the future anymore. It's about how do we understand the past. And that way of talking about the past, I would argue the Torah is very, let's say, wary of or very uncomfortable with as like a main way of referring to the past, or at least what I'd say is it seems not to be the way that the Torah wants to talk to us about the past. So how do we make this argument? Source number 8 is about the story we've been talking about. There's another Vayanosa Chutza, like he fled outside in this part. It's still about Yosef running away from Eshet Potiphar, from the wife of Potiphar. But the point here is that it's about, in a sense, the trial that ensues, right? She has a piece of his garment, or she's holding his garment. And as a result of that, she can hold an object up, a material object, and say, look, I have evidence. And I have a story, a plausible story that supports this evidence. So that is, in essence, what we're doing when we take observations in the present, and then we try to make stories about the past that seem to fit the evidence. And we know from the text that this story is a lie, but it is a convincing lie. And it's not implausible if you came in from the outside and you just said, okay, look, she's holding a shirt. Why isn't he wearing a shirt? She has an explanation for how things got that way. Maybe that's what happened. Is there a better explanation? And then what you find is that people arrive at one conclusion when they could have maybe arrived at another one. And sometimes maybe it's harder to think of another explanation. But the fundamental situation we always find ourselves in is there's always more than one explanation for the same evidence in the present. There's more than one account of the past that is at least consistent with that evidence. And then we need further criteria for ruling out certain accounts of the past and saying, no, that's not plausible for the following reason. It's interesting to note as well that this is not even the first time that a lie has been told about Yosef involving one of his own garments in order to convince something of what happened based on a plausible account that's consistent with the material evidence being held up. This is the very famous moment in Source 9 when the brothers of Yosef bring his ketonet pasim, his striped garment or his fancy garment, to their father, and they hold it up and they say, oh, look, here, it's soaked in blood. You know, do you recognize this? And he comes to a conclusion. Yaakov Avinu comes to a plausible conclusion. It's soaked in blood. Probably it's his blood. And probably therefore he was horribly injured, maybe by a beast. And the brothers don't even have to lie. They just let him do his forensic analysis based on evidence. And he comes again to a conclusion we know is not true because of what the text is telling us about what happens. So this is Yosef's curse in a sense, right? This has happened to him multiple times. Again, because he's this emblem of, let's talk about the world in this way. Let's think about what is rationalizable, what is reasonable, what is predictable, what makes sense based on the evidence, both looking towards the future and also looking at the past. And so far, the track record, according to the Torah, for how we talk about the world in this way is not such a good one, because we see two examples that are kind of harmful lies being told about Yosef just by using that kind of reasoning about the past. That doesn't mean that we don't think there's evidence for the Big Bang or that there were no dinosaurs or whatever, But I think what it just points to is that it's an epistemological question, right? If you're going to come to conclusions about the past from evidence in the present, which is always what that kind of science is doing, you need to think about what your methodology is, what the assumptions are that get you there, and you need to remember, which is perhaps the most important thing that the Torah is trying to call our attention to, that it is always the case that there are different people involved with telling these stories. And actually, sometimes there are agendas that are served by telling the story one way instead of another way. So be very careful about when we rule out certain other accounts of the past by certain criteria, whether that's actually being done because it serves someone's agenda, or whether it somehow has been done for some purely perfectly unbiased reason. Because I think maybe what the Torah is asking us in a kind of rhetorical way is there such a thing as a purely unbiased reason for ruling out an account of the past, or are you always supposed to have some kind of agenda? And then the question is, what agenda should you have? and how does that determine your criteria? So I think we're actually almost done with the sources, and then hopefully we can have a discussion about some of these ideas. But I think to finish up the idea, and this is a wonderful chidush that I owe to my wife, Elena, who first realized this about this passage, and it's my favorite Dvar Torah, is that in between these two lies that are told about Yosef, there is a different account of the past that is being shown to us. And it is a different kind of account of the past being supported by a different kind of evidence. Because there's this whole story about Tamar and Yehuda, this very peculiar story where he goes to shear sheep and she has to pretend that she's a prostitute or a cultic prostitute, covering her face. And then there's an agreement made between them about the exchange that's happening, where he has to give as a set of recognizable signs, like a password or a barcode, right? He's handing her his staff and his seal and his cord so that she can present them later for the goat that he owes her. But when she brings that to him, right, when she's suddenly on trial and says, oh, she has done something improper and she's now become pregnant, even though she's already engaged to be married to Shelah, she can present the staff and seal and cord, and he recognizes them, not because of some kind of forensic analysis of the data, right? It's because it's the sign of a brit, it's the sign of an agreement, it's the sign of a contract in a sense. And that's much harder to fake because it's like a signature. It stands out. I mean, really, the number three, you could say three things is a thing that Torah does over and over and over again to sort of say, this is so improbable that it becomes communication instead of just a random chance. And we could talk about other examples in this story, for example. These three signs, it's something that you can't fake. It's like walking into your room at home and finding a letter on the desk that says, Dear Rabbi Kelman, or to whomever. And you don't look at that and say, well, what if this was a random chemical reaction that was unlikely, but it just assembled a bunch of molecules together on my desk? Even if that happened, you'd be interested in what the letter said, because it's so improbable that in a sense, it's either someone coming to you and showing you the password, or it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu showing you the password because he wants to show you something and to tell you something. You could talk about whether things like this, of course, you can fake passwords or you can crack codes. So it's a little more complicated than that. But at any rate, I think the point is that when Yehuda recognizes these signs, it is not because he's convinced of some forensic account of the past in a scientific way. It's because he feels he's been told the right serial number, and now he has to kind of comply with the terms of an agreement to which he was a party. So this is what I would call the covenantal relationship to the past, right? This is not a forensic relationship. It's not based on science. It's based on agreement. It's based on a message. It's based on relationship. It's based on common language that you establish between parties who are trying to be faithful to each other. And I would really want to argue, we don't have time to flesh this all the way out. There's a whole other hour we could do on this, and maybe we will at some point, Bezat Hashem. I really think that this is the mode of talking about the past that the Torah wants to use. That is its chosen voice for talking about the past. And that has function in its purpose for us as a guide to Avodat Hashem. The point is that forensically rehashing the past is not what is considered of primary usefulness to the mission of the Oved Hashem. And so the Torah is not so much interested in that. What it's interested in, I'm going to skip over source 11 and we'll go back to it. What it's interested in is comparing the evidence before you to some set of signs that you are already familiar with and recognizing their relationship, such as, for example, in the explanation of this very curious and famous Rashi, where Lot serves matzot to the visitors in his home, and Rashi relays from Bereshit Rabba that was because it was Pesach, which is very confusing, because Pesach is something that we think of as a commemoration for something that happened hundreds of years later, not, you know, in the time of Lot. So what does that mean? What does it mean that Lot was celebrating Pesach? But what it's pointing out, in fact, is that there is a kind of exodus that's about to happen for Lot. And really, there are many exodi that happen in the Torah, including, for example, the one that happens to Avraham Avinu, right? That just as Bnei Yisrael eventually went down to Mitzrayim and then were trapped and held there by Paro, but then they were set free by mighty wonders and plagues that HaKadosh Baruch Hu visited on Paro. The same thing actually happened with Avraham Avinu and Sarah and Paro. And Rabban calls this Masevot Siman Nabanim, the deeds or the sort of events in the lives of the forefathers are assigned to the future generations. But what this is really about, I think, is the Torah trying to demonstrate to us that the Torah is a way of looking at history and the present and realizing the ways that they are the same, and then being able to take the Torah's account of the past and understand the meaning of the present and the moral imperatives of the present, because you've already been taught about them, right? So there are many Yitziot Mitzrayim, and there are many other models for events that either occur in the lives of individual peoples, people, or in the lives of Am Yisrael, etc., that we're meant to learn from this way. So it's actually a methodology for making the past interpretable and relevant for the present, which is tachlis, right? What are we going to do in the present? Why should we care about what happened in the past? Why does it matter whether there were dinosaurs or not, right? The forensic description of the past is curiously silent, or at least pretending to be silent on what we should do in the present. And sometimes that ambiguity is what makes it a little bit slippery. The Torah is trying to say, how should we look at the past so that it's a message, so that it's the authentication of a relationship that enjoins action upon you, that's part of a promise that you are a party to. And if that seems, you know, a little bit too strained to pull out of all these stories about Yosef and Tamar and Yehuda, I'll close with this source 11, which I think at the very least is Tanakh telling us all of this stuff is connected together. Why? Because there's a story in Sefer Shmuel Bet, which is about the life and times of the house of David, the Melech Yehuda, the first Melech Yehuda, the first Judaic king. He had a daughter named Tamar, and she had a ketonet pasim, curiously. She had a garment described the same way as the garment of Yosef, and she was the victim of a coerced sexual relationship that happened in her household, because her brother Amnon wanted to rape her because he desired her illicitly in the same way that Eshet Potiphar desired Yosef. And there are other parallels you can pull out of this whole story. It's also good for Hanukkah because she cooks levivot at some point, and we just finished Hanukkah. So it's, you know, all nice and neatly wrapped up with the timing of this shiur. But I only want to call attention to the source and encourage people to look at this story, because I think it's very much saying that you need to look at Yosef and Eshet Potiphar and Tamar and Yehuda all together and try to make something out of them. And that doesn't mean that's the only thing you can make out of them, but at the very least, you know, calls our attention to how the themes in each of these seemingly separate sets of events really weave together in a way that is part of the nivuah that the Torah is interesting, that the prophecy that the Torah is interested in sharing with us. So with that, we'll leave a little time for comments and questions and discussion, but this was what I wanted to try to get through today. I guess I'll look in the chat. Sorry, I should say. So this theory of predictability of natural world might explain away Yosef's interpretation of Paro's dream, but how would it explain Yosef's prediction about the baker and the butler? Ah, okay. So I love the baker and the butler as well. I think that's something you always could give different hypotheses about. I think one thing that's very interesting about the baker and the butler is that there you have two different people having seemingly separate dreams, which is different than the model presented in Paro or in Yosef. And I think one of the things that suggests is that maybe really we're talking about Yosef in prison and sort of his own double dream in prison, because that set of dreams read together, you can interpret into a lesson about how to be patient and sort of wait in a closed box like wine, instead of trying to grow fast like bread, which is part of what Yosef was having to learn from this period in his life. I also think if you're talking about like how did he know as a scientist or as a rational person what would have happened, it's notable that the 3 days in the dream is actually publicly available information, right? Because the Torah explicitly says that Paro had a birthday party 3 days later. So everyone would know Paro was going to have a birthday and be holding court and giving pardons and issuing decrees on his birthday 3 days later. And so in some sense, what Yosef is saying, he's being a bit of a psychiatrist, right? He's interpreting what perhaps the baker and the butler already kind of know is going to happen, and seeing that apparent in the fact that they're both anticipating this day that's very soon upcoming. The Midrash supports this idea a little bit, because also there's the question of what each of these people did. The butler handed Paro a glass of wine with a fly sitting in it, which might not have been his fault, because in principle, the fly could have landed in the glass after the butler handed it to Paro, whereas the baker baked a stone into a piece of bread that was given to Paro, which is not a miss that you can make easily. And the point is the difference between a stone and a fly is one is alive and one is not. So the stone didn't make its own way into the bread after the bread was baked. So to the degree that Yosef had access to those facts, for example, he may have just been able to say, okay, I think this guy is going to get pardoned and I think this guy's not. And that's going to happen in 3 days. So there may be a rational way of coming up with this. So next question, would scientists agronomists today be able to predict 7 good years followed by 7 bad years? So I have been loving a series of Shiurim on Torah in Motion by Rav Menachem Liebtag that I've been listening to about the number 7. And all the different things that you can make out of the number 7 in Chumash and beyond. And I think this is a perfect opportunity to make a point that he makes very beautifully, which is that when the Torah talks about 7 things, it's referring to something to do with creation and nature. And it's so 7 years, 7 times 7 years of the cycle of Yovel, etc. The 7 times 7 days of Sfirat HaOmer before Shavuot. We have it in Halacha in those examples. We also have it narratively. And the point is narratively here when this is happening, I don't think it's about 7 years good and bad per se, as much as the notion that there is natural predictability. 7, the world is created in 7 days by its creator, and that there is a predictability to when you make more grain and when you make less. And if you know how to predict that, then you sort of buy when it's low and sell when it's high. So it could easily be generalized into not just saying this specific window of 7 years, to just saying that this is really about recommending to Paro that he implement a system that uses predictably good harvests to mitigate and level out the problem with predictably bad harvests. And it might also be that in this particular instance, it was 7 years. And maybe sometimes there are cycles that last for more than 1 year that are maybe noticeable in nature. You have things like El Nino or whatever. So, if you want, I think there's a way of saying maybe there was some kind of 7 year cycle in the agronomy of Mitzrayim, but I don't think you have to say that. And in a sense, the text is saying much more to us. If you ask this question, those among the scientists who tend to dismiss faith and the unknowable would call for archaeological proof for Poe's dream. So I think that this is maybe a follow-on to the question that we had above, where the way I would put it is that, in a sense, we know, we don't know about 7 years of this followed by 7 years of that. I think that's not touchable by something like archaeology. And I very much follow the recommendation of Professor Rabbi Josh Berman at Bar Ilan, that we should be thinking about the kind of the text's choice to make these numbers carry important symbolic meaning, as I was referring to before. But I think what we do know about Mitzrayim, and in general about the sort of compact of the pagan god kings, in general, is that their promise was essentially, you are all my slaves, and I will protect you. I will protect you from that which is unpredictable about the natural world, right? That in a sense, the human condition, in the absence of political order and where individuals are bearing the brunt of nature's unpredictability, is terrifying and often, you know, a miserable existence and a short one. And people are willing to give a lot in exchange for mitigation of that condition. And so the Torah, in a sense, is just commenting with this story on the general terms of any Sumerian or Egyptian god king, right? That one way or another, when they're saying to their people, you have to obey me, people don't just obey stop because someone says, look, I'm a king. Like, you could put something on your head and people would not obey you. But they'll start to obey you when there's a collective sense that the system works and that they're getting their portion, and they're protected in the way that they want to be from, you know, whatever it is that they fear. And ideological systems based on idolatry and worship of god kings are all about instilling people with that, the sense of that, that's how the system works, and you need to submit to it because of what you get from it, which is, I think, also a very important lesson for today. This is a point that I've made more elaborately elsewhere, and, you know, it's another longer discussion, but we think, for example, about present day discussions about global climate change as though it's purely a question of the science, like, and science that no one could ever have done before, because now we have all this fancy technology. I think that really, in a sense, the story of Yosef is telling us about, you know, this is something very old. This is a very old discussion in politics about if there are things in nature that are perhaps predictable or controllable, how much political power do you give to someone to regulate every foot that rises and falls in Mitzrayim, in the language that Paro uses in recent Parshiyot, in order to save the world and save humanity. Now, that doesn't mean we've solved the problem of whether there is something that should be done about global climate change. I think what it does mean is that people who pretend that that discussion should mainly be one about whether the science is correct, and then we, of course, all know what we should do if it is correct, they're missing the point, which is that the most important part of the discussion is a moral and ideological discussion about human individual liberty and freedom and how that must be balanced against collective needs of a society. And is there a moral path forward when you, someone is telling you, I can predict the future, and I think what you should all do is become slaves to the government so that we can save ourselves? You know, that sounds like a good deal to people if the predictor is correct, because they don't want to die. But how sure do you have to be that the prediction is correct before you're willing to make yourself a slave to a god king? That is a worthwhile discussion that I think the Torah is really trying to prepare us for since thousands of years ago. Here's Yosef also set up a serf system when the Egyptians had to sell their land for grain. I agree with that. So maybe that was anticipating where we were going. The analysis that Yosef's dream includes the moon plus 12 astronomical items images is predicated upon an understanding that the moon is categorically different from the other items. We understand that, but the Ptolemaic system carried into the European Middle Ages did not. what was the understanding in Babylonian Egypt of the Middle and Late Bronze Age? So I shouldn't pretend that I'm in an archaeological sense knowledgeable about the end of that question. What I would say is that I think the Torah at least assumes our knowledge of the calendar as being based on months, because that's part of the mitzvot of the Torah. It's actually the first mitzvah in the Torah. Enough that the notion of the moon as having to do with months is something that we can, perhaps if we want, get away with introducing there. So it's not so much that the moon is considered different, but it's more like, I'm not saying, for example, that the 11 stars and the sun make 12 stars. We can say that there are 13 celestial objects being referred to here, but only one of them is the moon, and the moon is the one of them that pertains most to the idea of the setting of the calendar. So that was the point I was trying to make. Yosef and the wife were near the sea within sight of it. That's being posed as a question. I don't know of anything that would imply that. I think the point, maybe I lighted this in what I was saying, but the Midrash was referring to the bones of Yosef hundreds of years later that were being carried by Moshe. So the point is that the word Vayanos both appears in this verse in Tehillim and also in the story about Yosef and Eshet Potiphar. And so the sages are trying to unpack a relationship there based on that word, as they often do. And explaining the verse in Tehillim in Psalms by using the passage referring to events that happened a long time earlier. We're a few minutes over time. I'm happy to go for a few more questions. Rabbi Kelman, you could maybe nod or yeah, is that's okay? All right, so we'll proceed a little bit longer and then we can adjourn. And Sivan, I was asking whether Yosef, if doing it scientifically, could do something that maybe today we can't, or maybe we can. So that's an interesting question. I think people don't often give the ancients enough credit in the sense that I don't think people were less smart then. They were just, they had less developed ways of transmitting knowledge and also ideologies that didn't necessarily favor the transmission of certain kinds of knowledge in broad ways. So what kind of knowledge might have been possessed by the sort of priesthoods of pagan cults, for example, it may be hard for us to know entirely because it may have not been a secret that was necessarily shared broadly. And there are things about predictability that when you treat it like an empirical phenomenon, you don't have to understand why the weather is the way it is to notice there's something regular about weather, right? So if in a certain region of the world, there's a slightly periodic behavior, you don't need to be an advanced meteorologist of the 21st century in order to notice that and maybe exploit that. So it might be that when people had less notion of mechanism, they actually had some ability to notice empirical trends that were useful. And then that's certainly interesting today because of machine learning, right? Machine learning is a modern method that discovers useful predictability at a high level that we may have no mechanistic explanation for yet, but you can still use a computer model to detect that predictability once you process the data in the right way. Where is evidence in the text that Yosef was a farmer or knew of agriculture? He's identified as a shepherd. That's absolutely true. Maybe I should say a manager of a farming economy rather than a farmer himself. It's true that there's nowhere in Chumash that refers to Yosef himself planting seeds or plowing, but he clearly understood enough by the time he was having this conversation with Paro about agriculture that he could make recommendations about what to do. It seems like we have Rabbi Kelman's audio now. Is that correct?
Oh, I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Wow, I have no idea what happened. Okay, good. My wife is working on it, and we didn't think it worked. She left because after 10 minutes, we gave up. But here we are. Okay, so you can go a couple more minutes. No one's here. You don't have to hear me. They want to hear you answer the questions.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. So, Let's see. The brothers alter the evidence. True, they rip the garment off Yosef with no blood on it. Then they add blood and bring it to Yaakov. So the point that that's making, I guess, is that from that perspective, if the real evidence and not the doctored evidence had been presented, then Yaakov would have been less likely to come to a false conclusion, which I think is also a valid point. Like the point here is not that you never can learn anything about the past by looking at evidence in the present. I think that certainly when it comes to halakha, right, if we look at court cases, you know, where you go before Beit Din, they are interested in what kind of testimony that people can bring. And they are interested in whether that's consistent. Yeah, and especially, for example, if you're trying to prevent someone from being put to death, the job of the judges in the Sanhedrin was to try to find inconsistencies that would acquit. And so to do that, you need to reason based on this way of looking at the world. Another example I often present is the idea of psikresha. So psikresha is a halakhic concept that means that doing A will inevitably cause B to happen, and therefore you can't pretend that by doing A that you had no desire to make B happen. So, and the example that's given, which I didn't understand until I had kids, is that you want to chop a chicken's head off to give it to a child to play with on Shabbat, and you don't want to kill the chicken, you just want the chicken's head. And so you're trying to sort of say, well, I didn't know this chicken was going to die. And you're not allowed to do that because shechita, like cutting off a chicken's head 100% of the time kills the chicken. And the point is that's science, right? Science is not actually conceptually more complicated than that. That's the predictability of the world that you're noticing, and you're obligated in order to keep the Torah better to exploit your knowledge of that predictability. The same way that you can't say, well, I need wine for Kiddush, So I'll just wait and see if some falls out of the sky. You have to try to do what you normally have to do to get grapes or to get grape juice or whatever. There's aspects of the world's predictability that you're obligated to notice and make use of in order to be a successful Oved Hashem. So I think that's a very valid point. And it's showing that it's not the case that there's no such thing as better, cleaner evidence for what really did happen. But what's also true is that this is more ambiguous than we sometimes recognize, meaning that evidence always kind of passes through the hands of people who are collecting it. And their assumptions and their agendas are things that we shouldn't lose sight of. And it doesn't have to be a murder mystery. It can also be more mundane things that have to do with whole systems for developing forensic accounts of the past and what their ultimate goals are and what kind of a worldview that they propound. So what we don't know and can't do today, which our ancestors could do, in some cases it hints at advanced knowledge, and this advanced knowledge probably had something to do with their ability to connect to and access knowledge from a higher realm. What I will say about that, I think it's an interesting point, is that I think now, in a sense, the message of Tanakh has been so successful, partly through the spread throughout the world of Christianity, in discrediting, and also Islam to some extent, in discrediting the idea that idolatry works, that now we just kind of, it's very easy to be like, well, this is pointless, right? Why would you bow down to a statue and think that it's going to do something for you? And I think that misses the point, perhaps, of what was successful or useful about pagan mythologies. Like, idolatry wasn't, I think, to the degree that it ever did work, it wasn't magic. It was more that practices that actually helped you to, in some sense, survive and succeed in the world got encoded in the relationships that you had to have to certain rituals and also to idols and to the myths and stories that were told about the idols, etc. And it's a whole system, right? So in that system, it was much more easy for someone to say, this river is a person, essentially, right? And it has a personality and it has desires, and I could propitiate that individual and buy him off and get what I want from it. So I'll make these sacrifices and I'll get the river to do what I want, or I'll do the same thing for the earth or the winds or whatever. And we think of that as like, well, that doesn't work. Well, it might not be that you can actually control the winds by, you know, sacrificing hecatombs, but it might be that in the whole ideological system there, the practices encoded collective human activities that actually maybe did get you some better results in terms of, you know, why you would more successfully grow food at a certain time of year, or why you would more successfully, you know, take best advantage of the rain that did come, et cetera. So I think that we should think about whether, in the point being made here, which I think is an interesting one, there are some ways in which the ancients, who found it easier to look at things like the wind as a personality with a will or a desire, or the earth as a personality with a will or desire, that they would have in some ways found aspects of Avodat Hashem easier, because ultimately what the Torah is telling us is the creator of the world is a personality with desires and expectations. And that is a very hard kind of relationship to seek to the evidence of experience. If you're someone like Yosef, or maybe someone like a derivative of Yosef who's totally scientistic in their view, and then you're kind of shut off from realizing there are things that are predictable about the world that may actually be there to appreciate if you know how to kind of reach for them. And that's something we'll talk about actually in more in the next year, is knowledge from a higher realm of science or back to prophecy. I think I'll leave that to next time. It can be called science. I'm skipping down. Is that what? Yeah, so I think this starts to turn into where it should lead anyway, which is, I think we're going to talk more next time about Nivuah and the unpredictability and the predictability of the world and how they meet in the revelation to Moshe at Har Horev, and what does that have to do with what we've been talking about today. So I think it's a great entree to the next one.
Thank you. You can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I have no idea, but okay, I'm glad. I don't know, you were better. Okay, here we are. Okay, thank you very much. We'll look forward to next week. I'm sorry I couldn't introduce you. Not only is Dr. England, you know, a physicist, he taught at MIT. He taught at MIT, and he has smicha from Rabbi Bravender, and he's just recently made Aliyah. So I think it's a pleasure to welcome him to the Torah Motion team. So thank you very much, and look forward to the next couple of weeks. The rest of the week, as you know, the Shuli's class is finished for now this session. Please know we'll be starting up in the new year. But for the rest of the week, tomorrow night, Dr. Sokolow, how Tanakh was put together, 8 p.m. Thursday, Rabbi Karopkin, Daniel Karopkin will be giving the Parsha Shir 8:30 from the Rabbi Debate here in Toronto for a past president of the RCA. And Friday morning, I'll be giving my Shir on the Siddur at 9 a.m. We'll be back to Birkat HaShachar after a two-week hiatus for Al HaNisim. Okay, and we look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend, and we look forward to seeing with you. And thank you very much. Okay, and have a good one, everybody. Tzoraim tovim, erev tov, ba'aretz. Okay.